Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, my guest is Dr. Eric Mannheimer, a New York physician who's spent his career in public health. The last 15 as the medical director for one of America's largest and best-known public health hospitals, Bellevue. Internationally known for its criminal and psychiatric units, Bellevue is a full-service hospital. If something happens to the president in New York City, he goes to Bellevue. With the UN next door, Bellevue treats diplomats and the homeless on an equal footing. Dr. Mannheimer, who recently stepped down as medical director, has written an interesting account of how contemporary medicine is delivered in a hospital like Bellevue. 12 patients, life and death, at Bellevue Hospital follows those 12 patients, from dignitaries at the nearby United Nations to supermax prisoners from Rikers Island to illegal immigrants to Wall Street tycoons. Each case documents a larger truth about contemporary medicine and its intersection with all sorts of policies in the United States. Every societal and governmental debate show up in these patients, from foster home care and immigration to wealth inequities and correctional policy. Interestingly, the 12th patient documented in the book is Dr. Mannheimer himself. He survived a bout of cancer, and he writes about what it was like to wrestle with cancer as a patient, not a doctor. He joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Mannheimer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here, Rich. Thank you.
Your book, 12 Patients, is 12 case studies, but really what I was getting out of it is how modern-day medicine intersects with just about every sort of governmental policy available, everything from drug policy to correctional policy, foster homes, immigration. Was that one of the points you wanted to get across?
Rich, it really was. You know, what I wanted to use was the hospital that I work, Bellevue, which is a very unique place. It's the oldest hospital in the country, and it's a public hospital, and it's a real center of all kinds of emergencies and anything that happens in New York City. And I wanted to use it as a window into society and into modern medicine and how it's practiced and some of the demands on it, which are some of the, a lot of the issues you just mentioned.
Now, for those who outside of New York City, Bellevue is known as a place where possible criminal behavior, where people are taken for mental observation or confinement. But, of course, Bellevue is a full-service hospital, correct? And, in fact, it's probably one of the better trauma centers in New York.
No, Bellevue is that my two grandchildren were born there, and it has completely modern, up-to-date facilities in virtually every area. It has the largest emergency and trauma center in New York City. It's outstanding. If you're a cop that's injured or a fireman that's injured on the job, everybody goes immediately to Bellevue. And as you pointed out initially, Rich, we also take care of prisoners. We have a prison unit, which actually has 100 beds. So prisoners from the New York City prison system, which is the largest in the country, by the way, it has 11 prisons, are taken to Bellevue for care. But you're actually in a prison in the hospital.
And, in fact, one of the very first stories, one of the first 12 patients we meet is a patient who has been in and out. And it really talks about our national drug policy. He's never committed a violent crime, but he has been a chronic heroin abuser since his time in Vietnam. And he's dying. And it's about getting him out for compassionate leave from his sentence. Probably a violation of probation at some point or another, and being able to get treatment at home.
You know, precisely. This young man was had gone to Vietnam when he was about 17 years old and was a helicopter pilot and was, like many, many soldiers in Vietnam, had access to heroin in stupendous quantities and got addicted. And throughout his entire life, he just couldn't shake the addiction. He tried. He was married for 30-plus years. He had children, but he just couldn't shake it. And unfortunately, he got trapped in the criminal justice system. And for relatively trivial issues about possession of small amounts of drugs, he kept going back to prison. So he ended up spending half of his life in prison for really a very decent guy who served this country very well in a very, very unpopular war. So it was just an example I wanted to use of a guy who got trapped in a system that was much, much bigger than he was.
Of course, a little bit later, you have to contrast his story to that of a pseudonym which you used, Arnie. And Arnie is, well, he's probably one of these guys we've been cussing the last 4 years or so.
I think
he is a big investment banker who is absolutely, when we meet him, he's actually finally on the road back to sobriety. You actually tell his story through his 4-year AA pinning ceremony where he goes through his whole life story. But if the first patient we meet has had one strike against him and that has kept him in the system, this guy's going to have 100 strikes. He was addicted to virtually everything that would make you high and numb you from your life, and yet was still able to function in his business life, not his personal life. And he's never probably spent the only time he spent time in what we would call jail was his observation time at Bellevue.
You know, Rich, you're so right. And in my book, 12 Patients, what I wanted to do was contrast the first patient, whose name was Juan Guerra, with this gentleman, Arnie. And Arnie was the king of the world. He was a financial banker with unlimited resources, you know, a billionaire. And he ended up Bellevue because he was having chest pain, being driven to a meeting by his driver. And he appropriately asked the driver to take him to the closest hospital, which happened to be Bellevue. And it turned out, after he got admitted, and he was in fact having a heart attack, he had been addicted to about 12 different kinds of drugs, and he had manipulated the system successfully for about 10 years at that point to get access to virtually every narcotic and every other kind of addictive medication. And his was a long, long story. And I think, as you said so well, Rich, is that he literally had 100 chances, unlimited chances to remake his life. Well, the first patient, one strike, and he was doomed to be a recidivist in the prison system.
And, you know, in dealing with a patient like that, this is one of the things I think that I came away from the book with is, you know, Bellevue, you're working with the poorest of the poor, the people have literally nothing, and then with the United Nations practically next door, you're working with heads of state, you're working with people with diplomatic immunity, you're working with people like this Arnie, who was sort of a captain of industry, who expect, you know, just this incredible detailed service. And it seems like it would be very trying for your doctors and people at Bellevue.
Well, we do have, you know, on one bed, in one unit, we could have a patient from the UN, and we could have a guy who's a vagabond, you might say, off the street. And our doctors actually are quite used to that and in fact, challenged by it. We're the place where the President of the United States, if something happens, is designated to come to Bellevue. We work very closely with the Secret Service of the United States and federal marshals and every level of intelligence agency, particularly since 9/11. A considerable amount of my job has been working on anti-terrorism issues. So you're right, it is challenging. But our job is really simple in the sense that we want to take care of everybody that comes into the hospital and treat them all the same.
My guest today is Dr. Eric Manheimer. Until earlier this year, he was the chief medical officer at Bellevue Hospital in New York City from 1997 until earlier this year. He's now at the NYU's Medical Center. His book is titled 12 Patients, Life and Death at Bellevue Hospital, published by Grand Central, which you're changing the details of all their lives, but there's some pretty amazing stories in here. And, of course, one of the 12 patients is you yourself, Dr. Manheimer. You were diagnosed with cancer, and this is really what sort of started you on this path of writing.
No, absolutely, Rich. I was coming back from a vacation with my wife from Mexico, and I got hoarse. My wife had to stay an extra week, and I was just came back to the States, and I was hoarse. But it was a funny kind of sensation. And I very quickly went to one of my colleagues, and I said, look, could you just take a look? This is a little weird. And he looked down my throat with an instrument, an endoscope, and saw a small lesion the size of a small raisin near my right tonsil. And I did a biopsy, and literally 2.5 weeks later, I had turned from a doctor into a patient, and I was down a black hole. Very, very hard treatment for head and neck cancer, which is what I had, which had extended into several lymph glands in my right neck. And I underwent chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and a year later I had a major operation to take out the remaining tumor. So this was 4 years ago, and it started me on this journey to write down what I experienced and what I selected from out of the thousands of patients I'd seen over all the years, representative cases of really important issues in this country.
How did that change your viewpoint, the whole idea of going from doctor to patient? Now, from your writing, you seem like it would be a great doctor to have, a very compassionate man, very much interested in every individual patient's welfare. But I'm interested in how that change from doctor to patient, seeing how the care happens from the other side of the table, changed you.
Changed me profoundly. I just want to say the first thing is I had wonderful care. I received outstanding care from dedicated professionals. What changed for me tremendously is I had been a physician at this point for probably 33 years after graduating from medical school. I'd taken care of thousands and thousands of patients. I had taken care of many patients with the same disease that I had, but I had no idea. I think when you're a patient with an illness, you have a physician has no idea what the patient is really experiencing unless he's had something himself, unless he has the most remarkable amount of empathy that is almost doesn't exist in humanity. So what I realized is when I was getting better, because when I was very sick, I was in a very deep hole, and I was really cared for closely by my physicians and my family, particularly my wife. But I had no idea how hard, how painful, and how isolating the illness was. It gave me a completely different perspective on being very, very sick.
And I what I found interesting was even after you were out of the woods, it was like it took you a while to realize you could live your life again.
You know what? That was one of the most interesting things, Rich, is that my doctors told me, you know, hey, you know, in 6 months, 9 months, you'll be able to function and, you know, back to, not back to normal, but, you know, sort of intimating that it'd be much better. It took me a full 2 years to get to a place where I was really comfortable. I was petrified about a recurrence. I had actually had a recurrence, which I was feeling totally normal, and then it came back with a positive PET scan. So there I was thinking everything was fine and I was going to be okay, and then the PET scan could reveal something that you couldn't even feel. So it takes much, much longer to recover from these illnesses psychologically and physically than I think most doctors really appreciate. That was a deep, deep lesson for me to learn.
And I want to contrast your story. Could you explain your cancer type? Because there's another patient in the book that has the same cancer type.
Well, my cancer type is called squamous cell carcinoma, which is the typical cancer of the linings around your throat and mouth. That's squamous cell, SCC, we call it squamous cell carcinoma.
Yeah, and there was another patient in which you guys went to heroic details to make his last days comforting. He was a Mexican immigrant living in this country. There was this wonderful section where you're describing how doctors use their senses to understand what's happening, and in this case it was smell, because his legs had been amputated. He had this situation in his groin area. And he was dying, and not a wonderful death either, a very ugly death.
It was a horrible death. Yeah. Now, Rich, this guy was. I got a call one night in the middle of one night about a transfer of a patient from another hospital, and went in early the next morning. Went with one of my surgeons who was taking care of him to the unit, and there's a 32-year-old guy who had widely metastatic cancer throughout all of his pelvis and his abdomen. And it was eroding into his blood vessels, so his legs had to be amputated, as you mentioned, to prevent him from hemorrhaging to death. And at the end of the day, we decided there was no more treatment for this guy. And the one thing he wanted to do was he hadn't seen his children. He had three kids and his parents in 6 years. He'd been working like crazy to just send back some money to keep their heads above the economic waters. And what we decided to do was to take him home. And fortunately, I was able to accompany him because he needed a physician. He was that sick. And I was giving him morphine on a flight, Aeromexico flight to Mexico. We worked it out with the Mexican government, by the way. They were magnificent. Picked him up at the airport in an ambulance and drove him to the local hospital, which was a several-hour drive from Mexico City. And he lasted another month. But he died in his own room, his own bedroom, surrounded by his family.
And what was interesting, the way this came off, was this was a dollars and cents deal. It was far more cheaper to treat him in Mexico, the same level of care, than it would have been in the United States.
No, absolutely. You know, a day in our intensive care unit probably doesn't matter which hospital in the United States. A minimum is going to cost $3,000 or $4,000 when you add in all the different costs. And the Mexican government paid for the flight down. And the government, by the way, all of his care was picked up by their special, like, Medicaid system in Mexico. So it was it worked out actually perfectly from the economic point of view and from the humane point of view.
It's also a great learning experience because, as I mentioned, this book talks on all sorts of themes of governance. Here you learned a little bit about our immigration system and the family who had been trying to get to New York City to see, you know, and they're treated like utter criminals just trying to see a relative in the United States.
You know, his mom, the lovely woman, about 65, wanted to visit her son when he was in the hospital, thinking that he'd never be able to make it back home. And she went to the border, one of the border cities, and she just couldn't get a visa to visit her dying son. And it became one of these, you know, and she gave up. She thought she'd never see her son again. I mean, the one thing the mother wanted to do was to see her dying son. She could accept reality, but she just wanted to hug him and kiss him.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderfully told story. It's one of the stories of 12 patients, life and death at Bellevue Hospital, published by Grand Central. My guest today is the author, who until earlier this year was the chief medical officer at Bellevue Hospital in New York City for over, it looks like about 15 years, Dr. Eric Mannheimer, who's my guest today. The second story you tell us, boy, this is a troubling story. It is a story of foster home care, and it's a girl that you call Tanisha. And Tanisha, she was born of probably a mother who was probably a drug addict, couldn't take care of her, and bouncing around from foster home to foster home. In fact, at one point, authorities were basically calling her a feral child. And your team, I have to know, do you know where Tanisha is today?
I do, actually. I've kept in touch with her foster mother. And because I'd known her, yes, Tanisha's actually doing okay.
Tanisha is this amazing kid. You'll have to describe her to us, please.
Well, what happened, Bellevue is has a very large psychiatric unit, and I think a lot of people know it because of its large psychiatric unit. We actually have 350 beds for patients with mental problems. And amongst those, we have a very large psychiatric unit for kids. Well, one of the patients that came in one day was this young girl named Tanisha. She was a teenager, 16 years old, and I was on that day, and my psychiatrist friends asked me if I wanted to just go over to the psychiatric evaluation unit for kids, and I did, and I got to meet Tanisha, who had come to Bellevue to actually protect herself from the violence that she was experiencing within the adoption system. She'd been to 12 different adoptive families and most recently had been violated by a neighbor in one of the houses where she was in Brooklyn. And I followed her over the next few months. And one of the things the team and I decided was we were not going to let her go back into the system and be subjected to the kinds of criminal activity that she had been. And we worked really hard. And it turned out this girl was bright. She was creative. She was a wonderful artist. And we found a family that was loving and caring and responsible and was willing to take her and look after her. And they really, it was a love story. And she had a lot of, I don't want to minimize the emotional problems she has and the struggle it was to get her life back to some kind of normality, you know, that all kids really need. But it happened. It happened over several years, and she's doing well.
And it was interesting how you found out about the family. You know, she'd been in and out of foster homes, but there was one foster home where she did have a loving relationship. And it was from a Dominican immigrant. And she unfortunately had bad health problems and died. And so back into the system she went. But she had really had this loving relationship. And as a part of your treatment at Bellevue, you were doing some art therapy. She's drawing pictures, she's writing stories and journaling, and this is telling the story about this one loving relationship she had in her life, and that's how you managed to place her. It's a remarkable story.
No, that's exactly right. What happened was we really uncovered just by accident that she had been with this one family And through her artwork, she drew pictures, beautiful, colorful pictures. It was clearly a space in her life that had been full of love and caring and joy. And we got some more information. It had been one family, the mom had died, but the daughter was also a patient at Bellevue, and had her whole family had gone to Bellevue for care. And we tracked her down, and she was the one, when she realized how attached Tanisha had been to her mother and how attached her mother had been to Tanisha through reading the stories, she realized she was like one of her mother's kids. And so she accepted that responsibility. She was also a very loving and caring woman herself.
It was interesting because the stories that she wrote about in her journal and the pictures she drew were these stories that this mother had told her children. And then they also learned things about their mother that they had not known, that she had only told Tanisha.
Rich, precisely. That's why they accepted her. The family accepted her as one of their own, because when they read the journals, it was a very moving scene. I left the journals off with Tanisha's permission with the family for a couple of weeks, and they would all go over on the weekends. They were all working like crazy. These are not wealthy people. They had to work 6-7 days a week to survive. But they read through the journals, and it was like reading letters from a lost family member, somebody who knew the secrets of the family. And then when they realized that, then they said, this is really one of ours, and our responsibility is to take care of her.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear she's doing well, because this really points out just a lot of the troubles with the foster care. You know, in her life history, she'd probably been raped, probably by some of her caregivers, raped by neighbors of caregivers. Just a horrifying existence for a kid to have to grow up so early.
No, it's one of those things when these kids are subjected to violence, as you pointed out, at that age. It's for some of them, it becomes a life's effort to overcome, and many of them themselves become addicts and have enormous range of problems. Unfortunately, we see this much too often. These kids are just terrorized as 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds.
Yeah, and you contrast that with another girl in the same unit at the same time as Tanisha, who had had every advantage in life and was in basically the same situation, I mean, as far as their mental health.
You know, I think what happens is that kids that growing up in our society today are subjected to so many difficult issues, and they're exposed to sexuality very early. They're not able to handle it. They're exposed to an enormous range of illicit drugs. And a lot of them just are not emotionally capable of handling the stresses of our modern society. This other girl named Emily, again, family was a wealthy family, well-to-do, caring, loving. That was not the issue. But Emily, sort of by contagion, developed all of these mental issues. And the paradox with Emily was she almost got too much treatment. In New York City, there are so many different kinds of treatment and medications available and psychiatric consultations. She was almost overtreated, and the family was lost in a maze of diagnosis and psychiatry appointments and different kinds of contradictory therapies. And what we did is we took her off all of her medications. We kept her in the unit for a couple of months, and we really straightened out with the parents what the right pathway was. And that was the most helpful issue. So here we had one kid with no treatment, with no loving parents, and another kid with unlimited kinds of treatment, almost too much. In fact, there's too much medicine. There is such a thing as that.
Yeah.
That was Emily's problem.
Well, and this book deals into all sorts of issues. Of course, Bellevue has, as you mentioned earlier, a very strong trauma unit, and there is a story of the trauma unit, but it also gets into another issue of contemporary medical life, and that is medical mistakes. In this case, it's blood in the heat of the moment. One of the things interesting is when you were first starting out in public health in New York City, you know, New York City was probably the murder capital of the country, and all, I guess, physicians were very well trained at trauma on a daily basis. Now, as you were writing here in the early 2000s, trauma, vehicular trauma, still happens a lot, but gunfire and things like that's a slightly more rare event. And in the heat of the moment, mistakes were made.
You know, Rich, you're so right. So when I trained in New York City, it was at the end of the Vietnam War, and the physicians that came back were incredibly well-trained. And as you said, New York City during this time, and even the United States, was in a great recession, and there was enormous amount of violence. And the knife and gun club, as we call it, were extremely active. There were over 3,500 murders in New York City, and now, just to put it in contrast, there are about 300 murders in New York, so it's a very safe city. And consequently, the trauma surgeons really don't learn much trauma. They, in fact, around the country, trauma is way down. So it's vehicular trauma, motor vehicle trauma, but not much in terms of other kinds of trauma. But what happened here was a terrible error. The young woman, was in her 30s, was just with her boyfriend, her husband, and they were walking in lower part of Manhattan, and a guy came and grabbed her pocketbook, and she resisted, and he shot her in her femoral artery, in her left femoral artery, and she was bleeding out on the sidewalk, and she got taken to Bellevue, but she was almost dead. Her tank was empty. She was just about not making it. They got her, rushed her up to the operating room, and we had a team of surgeons, and we had them there. They live in the hospital, essentially, working on her immediately. But unfortunately, another trauma came in exactly the same time, and a guy who had been hit by a taxi cab nearly took his leg off. And the blood for the guy got given to this girl, and they obviously weren't the same type. So it was just the heat of the moment. The anesthesiologist gave her 8 units of this guy's blood. This guy was actually a visiting dignitary from Brazil. And as you said, with the UN being close by. So what happened was she survived by sheer luck that she did not have a life-threatening reaction to the wrong blood. But it just goes to show you, here are these highly trained people. A lot of these guys, by the way, had trained in Vietnam and were very experienced. And they gave her, just in the heat of the moment, to save her life, these two traumas coming in at the same time, the blood got mixed, and she was just lucky. She's fine. She did totally fine. But the point here was how under the heat of different moments things can change, and how complicated medicine is. You're making thousands of decisions on every patient during the course of one hospitalization.
It was interesting. One of the lines you wrote was, you know, one of the greatest innovations to reducing medical mistakes in an ICU is pencil and paper, checklist.
Yeah. Rich, you know, and so many people think you got to spend another $1 million on a new computer program and that'll improve it. I've seen this kind of seduction by magic that something, if you do something else is going to happen. And really, the most important things have been with what we call checklists, where you just go down a checklist and you look a nurse in the eye or another doctor in the eye, and you just go down together and you say yes, yes, no, yes. And you communicate face to face. It's not through some magic. It's back to basics. Medicine is really learning the lessons from aviation. A lot of the lessons that were learned in aviation back in the 60s and 70s about checklists and a whole variety of other things, learning from errors and then building in these solutions, we are really adopting. So we're coming a little late to the knowledge that is achieved in other high-risk industries. Another one is the Army in aircraft carriers, nuclear power plant safety. But particularly airline safety has been the model for medicine.
All right. Well, there are many more stories in the book as well. The name of the book is 12 Patients. Dr. Manheimer, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's really been my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Dr. Eric Manheimer is the former chief medical officer at Bellevue Hospital and the author of 12 Patients, Life and Death at Bellevue Hospital. It's published by Grand Central. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.